welcome to another edition of Money Matters, your economic forum. Member discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge. This station and staff members are underwriters, and indices mentioned are unmanaged. It cannot be invested in directly. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. We hope not. Welcome. My name's Mark Cunaberdy. Welcome to the 279th edition of Money Matters, entitled, When Will It Stop? Money Matters is about money. As money is matter, and matters of money affects us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet in some way or another, controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money or lack of it or abundance of it. It's about your life and livelihood. Life and livelihood, in short, it's about you. Okay. All right, so on we go, right? When will it stop? When will it stop? The questions that we have. Okay, so we'll cover some basics, first of all. We talked about these large numbers. You know, 1,000, 2,000, 20,000, 21,000, 22,000, 23,000, 24,000. Those are large numbers. So when we're in between those large numbers, if you're at 23,500, 23,000 and below it is what we call a major technical support level. And 24,000 above it would be a major resistance level. Now, there are other technical resistance levels all over the place, but most people that believe in technical analysis believe that these larger numbers are milestones. Keep in mind that no technical analysis or no analysis of any kind can tell you where a market goes, because it's all just the perception of all the players in it at any given moment. I always say the market will reflect reality in time, but its day-to-day movements are only the perception of all the players in it at that given moment. So the Dow now down at 22,890. It had blown through 23,003-something, which was the first recent low. Went up, and then a couple of months later, touched down to about 23.4. So that was what we call might call a double bottom. And then it went up again, and then down through 23,300 again. That could have been a triple bottom. However, it has dropped below that 23,330. Down another 433 at 22,890. So that would mean that 22,890, 23,000 above us would be a resistance level now, and 22,000 below us would be a support level. Maybe. It's difficult. I know it is very difficult, and we're going to talk about what you can do, what to expect. It's tough to tell you what to expect. You know, the economic stats out are pretty good. So I think this thing just ran a lot. Since Trump was elected, it was in the 17,000 mids and ran to 26,833, if I have my numbers right. And since then, it's just been eroding and cratering and back again and down again. You know, I will tell you, if it's any consolation, markets don't fall forever. I can comfortably say that. They don't fall forever. This will stop, but we don't know where. So far, it's been pretty broad-based and brutal. This is the worst December for the stock market, the worst December from December 1st to now since 1929. So that's just December, though. This isn't the worst correction we've ever seen. Obviously, the crisis of 08 and 09 and 1929 were horrendous corrections, all the way down to 6,500 on the Dow before that stopped. What's driving this? A variety of factors could be said to be driving this investment sentiment. This is basically what we call risk off. There's a risk on and risk off. Risk on means everybody believes the stock market is going to go up and they take risk and they buy stocks. Risk off means everybody believes the stock market may fall and there's risk in it, so they go risk off, which is basically they sell securities. Now, what we're saying, people say, why is the Dow dropping? Why is the S&P dropping? Why is the Nasdaq dropping? Well, there's more sellers than buyers. I mean, it's as simple as that. If there are more sellers than buyers. Could a market drop with great economic fundamentals behind it? Yes. Could a market rise with bad economic fundamentals behind it? Yes, it can. And you've got all the talking heads all over CNBC and every sort of newsletter are all putting together their prognostications. Now, I can tell you that I can show you 10 newsletters that would tell you that this stock market is going further down. Some of them will say badly, some of them will say a little bit. And then I could show you 10 more that would convince you that the market's going to run. So it's difficult. You know, what do we do when these things happen? We don't know, and the imagination drifts to, I will lose it all or lose a lot of it. And so some investors, you know, the traditional belief is hold for the long term. It's painful when you see your balances dropping and your hard-earned money evaporating. I will tell you that when you see the Dow and the NASDAQ and the S&P and the stock market sell off, that money comes out of the market and it does go somewhere. Okay, there are things that are rising at this time. The issue is that if you buy things that have a tendency to rise when markets fall, when the markets turn and run, these things will have a tendency to fall. So the strategies, at least that I undertake for protection is really the key. I very rarely sell everything. Very rarely do that, because then if the market turns and runs and you just don't know when it'll do that, you won't participate and you'll just lock in your losses. However, what we do is we utilize, at least where I am, we utilize stops. And stops basically says as the market continues to fall, we start selling off equity positions, stock positions, and going more to cash or things that may have a tendency to rise when the market falls. And the more the market falls, the more we eject. So you might, when the market starts to fall, portfolio might fall in concert with it. And then as you start to eject equities, the fall will not be proportional. And then the more equities you eject and go into cash, your rate of descent will slow, even though the market might accelerate. So that's how we do it, because, you know, we don't know when this market's going to stop. It has really been brutal, broad-based and brutal. It has been a lot of different asset classes have sold off. There are a few asset classes that we've seen green, for instance, today. Being December 20th, 2018, 12:16 p.m. Pacific Standard Time in the year of our Lord. Yes, we see American Barrick, which is a gold company, is rising today. We have seen precious metals kind of rise a little bit in the sell-off. You know, some of the indexes have been totally brutalized, and some golden indexes, silver indexes have been rising. That doesn't mean they will continue to rise, but it does show that there are things that people are buying. Some of the consumer staples, which normally would rise in a falling market, are still down to themselves. What are the other things that are rising today? Emerging markets are up a little bit today. Japan is down, but the Brazil market is up. And interestingly enough, the Brazil market has been fairly resilient through this whole thing. Some of the other alternative currencies of the Australian currency is up a little bit today. The junior gold index is up a little bit today. Gold is up a pretty good spot. It's up $20 today right now as I speak. Most of the technology shares are down, but tomorrow it can do the exact opposite. So percentage-wise, not a lot, but it's still down. And tobacco is down, which is interesting. Usually tobacco has a tendency to rise when the market sells off, and it has been brutally hammered in the sell-off. I didn't see any news on that, although there may be. And a couple of the cybersecurity stocks are rising a little bit today. Nothing really rising a lot. A silver share, silver index is up 20 cents today. That's held up remarkably well. But remember, when the market was running, it got fairly slaughtered as well. The volatility index, which measures the volatility or the fear index of investors, is up, obviously. This is not a solicitation or a recommendation to buy or sell these stocks. It's just a notation of what my screen is showing. And utilities are up a little bit. Utilities have a tendency to rise when the market falls off. And indeed, we do see a kind of a sloping curve upward since the beginning of October with the XLU, which is utilities, Select Spiders Trust. Utilities right around October when the market started to fall was sitting around 51.5, and it went all the way to 57, and last couple of days it dropped to 54.5. So what does that tell you? It really doesn't tell you much, you know. Hiding out in cash and cash equivalents, you know, short-term T-bills, anything that has real short-term maturities, it might be a place that people might consider where to hide out. And so it is a difficult environment. You can call me, by the way, if you're listening to the show live today. And so the Dow, as we speak, really has been relentless, just relentless, down 399. So I believe it was yesterday, I'm pretty sure it was yesterday, the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, appointed by Trump, I think it was yesterday, I think it was Thursday or Friday, I should know that, a Thursday or a Wednesday, but I've been extremely busy, as you might indicate, as you might know. So there you go. You know, where to go from here. An article came out, don't look now, but the dreaded death cross has occurred in the S&P 500 index. What is a death cross? Sounds horrendous, doesn't it? And you read an article like that and you think, oh no, a rare indicator, a bad one, supposedly, has been triggered. So what is the death cross? The death cross, I think it's also getting close to occur in the Dow. Let me see if I can punch that up before... let's see if I've got that there. No, I don't. It might take me a while to find it. I could find it. But in any case, it has occurred in the S&P 500 index. That's a very large index. This horrible-sounding technical indicator, considered by some market analysts as an omen worth noting, is when the 50-day moving average of the S&P 500 closing price crosses and falls below the 200 moving average. So, what's a moving average? Well, 50-day weather average. We go 50 days back from today, and we take all the weather of the day at a certain particular time. In the stock market, it's closing time. And we add up all the weather, the average, all the temperatures at the same part of the day over the last 50 days, and then we divide it by 50. And then you get an average, right, of what the temperature has been over 50 days. 200-day does the same thing. It looks back 200 days, so we would take it from today and look at the temperature at the same time every day for the last 200 days, divide them by 200, and we get an average. That's pretty easy math. Although I was told you there'd be no advanced math on this show, that's as advanced as it's going to get. So what happens is the 50-day moving average moves quicker than the 200-day moving average because you have a larger sample set, right? 50 days, you know, one of today would be 1/50th of the index. And of the average, and 200 days, one today would be 1/200th. So the 50-day moves quicker. So what happens is you see the 200-day is rising, and the stock market starts to fall hard. The 200-day would start to turn down, usually rather gently, not necessarily so, but usually gently. But the 50-day would turn down faster. So if the 50-day is usually above the 200-day moving average, which is what it is in a rising market, then when the market starts to fall, the 200-day would start to fall, but the 50-day would fall further. And when it crosses in the downward direction, that's called the death cross. Yee. The theory is the longer the 200, the long 200-day average is syncing up with the shorter 50-day average, which indicates a larger and more significant move to the downside is about to occur. And then you conversely say if the 50-day moves up and crosses the 200-day in the upward direction, that may be an indicator that good things are to come. Now, how accurate is that? Well, some technical analysts believe that, but let's really take a look at what's been happening. Before you go calling your broker and hitting the sell button with your crash helmet strapped tight, know this. There is no indicator that is foolproof nor human that is infallible that can predict in any way, shape, form, or time frame what is about to happen in this sociological world, which is the stock market. Remember, it's not math. It's not math. Stock is not math. The stock market is not math. It's sociological. It's a study of sociology. Because you've got just the people that move it are all humans, and they all have different opinions, and you can't quantify an opinion, nor can you quantify the summation of all the players in the market at any one time. So it's sociological study. The death cross, did come before two recent market implosions. Okay, so it was a valid indicator in the dot-com crash in 2000 and in 2008. Death cross occurred, and then the dot-com crash and the 2008 crisis began. But this death cross has also appeared near or at important stock bottoms, which means when the death cross occurred, it was followed by healthy gains. So there you go, right? So much for the dreaded part of the moniker, death cross. Drilling down into how valid this indicator might be, we find 33 such death crosses if we look back at the last 68 years, 1950. So 33 such death crosses have occurred in the last 68 years since 1950. And this one is number 34. The good news is that only four of these death crosses has preceded a bear market greater than 20%, which occurred within 2 years from when the death cross occurred. So in other words, only four times when the death cross happened in the next 2 years did we see a market that had a greater than 20% crash. 22 death crosses also preceded a gain in the index within 6 to 12 months. So it happened 22 times, and then the index gained in whatever index it happened on. So within a 22, more of them indicated a rise than a fall. Averaging out all the past 33 crosses, and not including this one, which is 34, we get a gain of about 8.6% a year later. So the death cross, it's kind of tough to say death cross. Okay, so the death cross, at least when we average it out, indicates an 8.6% gain in the following year, a year later. Maybe they should rename it, given the average result looks to be positive and a harbinger of good things to come instead of bad. This goes to show also that technical stock indicators have their place, but it's a limited size place at that. No indicator is foolproof, and attaching a scary name to one, like Death Cross, doesn't make it more valid, although it may sell more newspapers and newsletters. After all, what novice would ignore a Death Cross indicator when announced on the news, either in theory or in the real world? Only time will tell, obviously, if this new Death Cross will bear out a good or bad outcome. But it's safe to say markets don't fall forever, like when I began the show. Markets don't fall forever. Not that they couldn't fall forever. I guess they could. It's just never happened. Even the worst markets eventually turns up historically. That's not to say a falling market can't do damage, as you well know now. Indeed, we've given back the gains from 2018. Most of the index have been given back. And then some. Indeed, the latest go-around has wiped some profits from the slate and maybe has wiped some principal from the slate. And most likely from investor portfolios, including yours maybe, and depending on what you hold, the damage and the time to recover could be significant. It may take a while. That's not a pleasant reality. I understand that. We can only hope that before they plug a cross over me, right, before I die and they put a real cross over me, the market will have recovered nicely and then some. I'm 63. When will I die? I don't know. I've got a goal of 128. So I got 65 more years good to go. At least that's what I'm hoping for. If I had my way, I would not prefer to see any death crosses at all, right? Either in theory or in reality. But we will see. Remember, indexes referenced in this little blurb cannot be invested in directly. Okay, so we'll be right back with Money Matters. Thanks for joining me today. My name's Mark, and hang tight, and we'll be right back. I'm in the- All right. So there we go. So taking a look at the Dow. Everybody's kind of interested in that. It's the biggest index that people look at anyway. Down 394, 393. Unrelenting. So we'll see. Maybe if it stays above 23,000 on the close, maybe that might be resistance point. We shall see. You know, for those investors that just don't want to see negative balances, okay? There are other alternatives. Obviously, savings accounts. Okay? Savings accounts. There are other things in the investing world. Short-term treasuries, real short-term treasuries, they generally don't move much. They can move. Most people think that bonds perhaps don't move as much, but in 08, 09, they had a little trouble, a lot of trouble, for sure. So this next little blurb, regulators approved me to put this out, so I'm going to put this out. There is things called annuities. I wasn't a big fan of annuities for the longest time. I saw too many of them with high fees, complicated term, and so many hooks I had to get out my tackle box to house them all. Now, an annuity is basically a contract between you and an insurance company. They're not federally insured. Could an insurance company go broke? I suppose so. I suppose so. They're pretty big, so some might think they're too big to fail, but the reality is they could. That said, when I started offering annuities to clients with specific needs and desires not too long ago, I reviewed literally hundreds of them, and in the pile, I found a few I thought advantageous. First off, like I said, the description of an annuity is a contract between an insurance company and a person that stipulates in return for a sum of money paid by you, either in a lump sum or in installments, the company will then, in this particular annuity, promise payments over a period of time so they can... One's called an income annuity. You basically give them money for a long time. You let it sit there. And then when you're ready to pull the trigger, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, or whatever, you call them and you say, how much will you pay me until I die? And they'll give you an amount. Okay? The amount varies according to how long you leave the money in there, the terms of the contract that the insurance company has put forth to you, your age, right? Obviously, you're older, you're not going to live as long, so you're probably going to get paid more. And it's common, it's probably safe to say that when you open up at least this type of annuity, the longer you put your money in, the better off you're going to be. Most annuities, not all, will offer you a guarantee of principal. So you can't lose any money. We will promise you won't lose any money. There are annuities that don't have that guarantee, but the ones that I look at would have that. Then some of the annuities will pay you a guaranteed interest rate. Usually not much in this environment. They might pay you 1% a year compounded or whatever. Nice thing about annuity is if you hold it outside of an IRA, it's not taxed. At least United States annuities are. Swiss annuities and other annuities, foreign annuities are taxed or regarded as debt instruments. That was ruled by the IRS in the year 2000, I believe. But American annuities, for the most part, are not taxable until you reach the end or until you start taking income, okay? And then you're taxed over and above what you put in there. Now, I'm not allowed to give tax advice, so that's, I'm going to say, consult your CPA with the contractor of the annuity and bring it to them, and then they can review it for you. So it's a contract, and I call my own terms as one is an income annuity and one is an accumulator. Now, what's the difference? Well, both of them, you put money in a lump sum, or you put money in over time. You put in $500 a month or $10,000 a year, whatever you want to put in. Okay? Insurance company keeps that money, plays with it, whatever they do with it, and it grows. The income annuity, you let it sit in there. The longer you sit in there, then they'll come out and they'll say, okay, we'll pay you this much until you die. And you can wrap a spouse in there. You could say, okay, you're going to pay me this much until I die, until she dies. Now, if they have to wait for two people to die, they'll usually pay you less. And then what they'll do, some annuities will also fix it to an index. So in other words, in a particular annuity that I've looked at, they'll guarantee you 1% compounded at the minimum. And then they will say every certain day, every year, every certain day, every 2 years, We will measure the index that's that you've selected. Let's say it's the S&P 500. And wherever the index is when you open the annuity, it has a number, okay? Like today's number for the S&P is 2475. So if it closes there and your annuity became effective today, that would be your number, 2475. And in a particular annuity, they might call it a two-year point-to-point annuity. They will measure the S&P index 2 years from today on that very day, and it closes. And they will say, we will give you a portion of the gain, whatever the portion may be, third, two-thirds, whatever, and they keep the other half. Then what happens is the index now has a new number, right? The two-year anniversary, it has a new number. Maybe it went up. So if it went up, that's your new number. Now, let's say in the next 2 years, the index falls, okay? Some annuities will not take away what they already gave you. In other words, you won't be penalized for the decrease in the index. So it falls and falls and falls. You still get the amount from the two-year anniversary. You don't get it, but it's in the account. And then when it measured again in 2 years from that second anniversary, then that'll be your new number. So let's say it falls down to 2,000. That's your new number. And when it rises from 2,000 to 2,400, if it rises 2,000, 2,400, you get, again, a certain portion, whatever that portion is, of that gain. And they add it to the previous gain. So your balances only go up. They can't go down. And I find for people that, don't want to see a declining balance, then this might be for them. They will participate in an up market if it rises and stays up at the anniversary date. But they won't see it go down. Now, with this annuity and all annuities, because they want the money in for a long period of time because they're guaranteeing you a certain thing, some annuities will allow you to take out a certain percent a year, usually after the first year, without any fees or penalties. So an annuity that I'm familiar with lets you take out 10% a year after the first year, and they won't penalize you. Now, that 10% you took out doesn't stay in the market anymore. It doesn't stay in the annuity because you took it out. But you can take out 10% a year. Now, if you take out more than whatever the insurance company says you can take out, whether 8, 10, 5, then they hammer you. In the first year, they hammer you a lot. And then in the second year, they don't hammer you so much. In the third year, they don't hammer you as much. And it goes down to the annuity is at the end, and then it's zero. So what I find with annuities sometimes is people will get their statement. Let's say they put in 100 grand, okay, and they get their statement, and they're told by the advisor that the they'll have a guaranteed principal, and the principal amount on the contract where you put in 100, they get the first year statement, and it says the balance is 94 grand, and they call their advisor and they say, "Hey, why is it 94 grand? You told me you would never go negative," because the annuity companies are required to tell you what it would happen if you took it out then. So if you took it out in a year and you took it all out, you're taking it out early. So that number reflects the prepayment penalty. But that does go to zero until the end of the new, when the end of the annuity is reached. So when you get your first annuity statement, don't freak out. It's basically saying, if you do what you said you wouldn't do, which is keep your money in there for 7 years or 10 years or whatever, this is what we will penalize you. But if you keep it to the end, then that's what you get. That's an income annuity. And you can wrap it on you and your spouse. So it's somebody that doesn't want to outlive their money. They give a certain amount of money to the insurance company. And that way, when they mature and they're ready for the income, the annuity company can pay you, will pay you, if it's that type of annuity. They'll pay you for the rest of your life until you kick the bucket. And so you really can't outlive your money that way. Versus if you had 100 grand and you took out 6% a year or 4% a year, it'll eventually run out. Then there's an accumulator annuity. That's a little bit different. Instead of paying you income, you basically put the money in, might have the same terms, similar terms, keep the money in. You might be able to draw a little bit every year after the first year without penalty. If you take out more, they're going to hammer you more in the first year, a little bit less in the second year, et cetera, et cetera. But instead of paying you income at the end of the annuity, they just give you a lump sum. They say, here's your lump sum. Okay. Guaranteed interest rate, not plus. They don't add the interest rate if you make a gain in the underlying market. So that's how they work. And for some investors that are paranoid and don't like to see declining balances and just can't stomach declining balances, this could be an option for you. Now, remember, you should consider carefully the investment objectives, risks, fees, and expenses in annuities before investing. For this and other important information, please obtain the investment company fund prospectus and disclosure documents from your rep advisor. Read this information carefully before investing. Guarantees are based on the claims paying ability of the insurance company, not the feds. Okay? So annuities might be a way to go. You know, for a long time, I didn't like them. But now there are some that I've lifted that opinion. So let's take a look at the Dow down 371. It doesn't look like it's going to do anything positive today, but we still have 19 minutes. You never know. Could turn around and run from there. So remember, if declining balances is making you squirrely, making you lose sleep, they always say sell down to the sleep portion of the portfolio. In other words, sell down to where you can sleep. If declining balances are making you nervous, you know, I had a client yesterday called me and he wanted to get out of a portion of equity stocks to go to more cash, which we were doing anyway on the stops. You know, as it went down, we were offing some securities to go to more cash, and he wanted to go to more cash. He was a little bit more concerned, so not a problem. Remember, your advisor is a fiduciary, which means we have to do what's best interest of you. And new rules, new transparency rules are out, are making that more, making us more transparent. I like to say I was always transparent, but, you know, the fiduciary rules, all the rep advisors should be fiduciaries. And I could comfortably say in the past that there have been some advisors, whether it be 10 years or 100 years ago, that maybe did not have that, you know, did not have that stance. Can't say that for sure, but, you know, we can pretty much guarantee that. There were some that were probably shady, but so some of them went to jail, right? But fiduciary means that they have your best interests in heart. Also, the rules are going away from more commission-based products. So if they sell you something, they take a cut. Now it's more fee-based. It basically says, you know, they charge you 1% or 2% or whatever of your whole holdings. And if you make more money, they make more because the 2% is of a more higher amount. Or if you make less, they make less. So they don't have any incentive. Not saying some do. But some advisors don't have any incentive to buy or sell anything in your account. And some advisory firms even pay your trade fees, so you don't get any fees at all, except for the percentage that they charge you. In our particular firm, we charge you $1 if you take a statement. Now, we do have fees, but you know, some advisors will charge you. If you want paper statements versus having your emailed statements, they charge you $1 for the paper, so or whatever they charge you. So how do you build a winning portfolio? It's important, you know. I mean, when the markets fall, we have something in modern portfolio theory called market risk. You know, there are a lot of risks, standard risks that are assumed in investing, and they could be geopolitical risk. You know, you buy stock in Venezuela, and Venezuela confiscates the company. That's a geopolitical risk. You could have interest rate risk, where interest rates rise, which is what the Federal Reserve did Wednesday or Thursday. They raised them by, I think it was a quarter of a point. They keep going in gently. Federal Reserve Chief David Powell, appointed by Trump, has now got the Fed's overnight rate somewhere around 2-something and went up another quarter point and indicated that possibly there would be another 2 next year. And that did not bode well for the market. Some believe that that has been a catalyst to further the damage of this market. Tariffs, in my opinion, tariffs were a big part of it. When you start slamming tariffs on countries, they stop buying your exports and your company's hurt. And in my opinion, those loss in export sales from our companies has been showing up. And that is a concern. Also, if you have people in Washington that are kind of wishy-washy, and I'm not saying they are, but if they post one thing one day and another thing another day, you know, markets don't like uncertainty. So that could be driving this. You know, there's a lot of the country that is not in favor of the administration, and there are some that are. A lot of the people in the nation are. I don't know if it's split 50-50 or not. I've never seen a survey like that. But I can comfortably say that both sides of the aisle don't like uncertainty. They don't like when somebody says something and then come back the next day and say something else. It jerks the market around. And for the most part, I do not think investment firms like tariffs. You know, I wrote an article that tariffs are inflationary, and I'd rather see a tax credit than tariffs, because the tariff goes to the government, and you end up paying more for whatever is tariffed. Where a tax credit would protect the domestic company that you're trying to protect in the interest of the first tariff, which was steel. You put give a tax credit to American companies, and that lowers the price of all steel. because it's an average price, right? Average price of steel. So if an American companies are giving a tax credit and they can sell their steel for less, that lowers the average of the price. So as a general rule, tariffs are inflationary, and these consumer gets screwed by them. And as another general rule, in my opinion, that tax credits would be a much better solution because all of us would benefit from that. The government wouldn't get any money. But, you know, are they really for the little guy or for themselves? No matter who's in there. But both sides of the aisle have always instigated tariffs, and I'm not really not a big fan. I think it hurts the little guy. And the little guy is hurting. I mean, there's no doubt about it. That disposable income, nominal income has been rising, of course, with inflation. Nominal is just the number. How much do you make? But inflation erodes purchasing power of paychecks, and paychecks never keep up with the rising rate of inflation. And another hidden little worm in inflation is that if you keep having inflation and your wages don't keep up, you get hurt there. But as inflation raises the price of everything, your paycheck will go up. You'll get in a higher tax bracket. So not only are you being hurt because your wages aren't increasing as much as the overall price index is, so you're paying more but not making as much as the increases in the price index, eventually you'll get into a higher tax bracket. So you get a double whammy. Don't think the economy, the economists at the feds know this? Sure they do. I mean, inflation is known as the stealth tax. I mean, it basically transfers wealth from the low income to the very, very upper income. It's why you see the income concentrating at the top. It's a pyramid. Not a pyramid scheme, but the shape of how where wealth goes is a pyramid. You have more inflation. In my opinion, it hurts the lowest income, and inflation goes up the ladder. And the more you have inflation, you can see it in banana republic countries, we talk about tropical countries like Mexico and Venezuela and Peru that practice inflation through money creation, money printing, as it's called. And you see the wealth concentrated higher and higher at the top till, you know, 90% of the population is broke. And when I was growing up, my bus driver used to be able to go to the doctor, has four kids, and go to Disneyland on a bus driver's salary. But now two parents work, and you have a heck of a time just making ends meet. And so it's difficult. And when that happens, you know, when that happens, the call for more public assistance goes out. And when the call for more public assistance goes out, then politicians get elected who advocate public assistance. And to pay for that public assistance, the government prints more money. They'll borrow some money to pay for it too, but they'll basically print a lot of it as well. And when they print more money goes into the system, causing more inflation, which causes more people to fall further behind. More inflation causes more people to pay higher taxes because they go into higher tax brackets, and then more people call for public assistance. And then the government gets elected who promise public assistance, and those that want a sound dollar economy and start to cut back on programs don't get elected, and more people in power toe the party line of inflation. Let's hand out more checks. And that causes more inflation, causing more people to go broke, and then the wealth, when a person goes broke, you know, right, when a person falls under the bus economically, you know, money is never is destroyed, really, unless you burn it in a pile, you know, but there's a, you know, my belief is the wealth is never destroyed, like energy. Energy is never destroyed. It just takes a different form. And so when wealth is destroyed at the lower income classes, it moves up the chain. It goes up to the richer. So, you know, in my opinion, it's not corporate greed that causes you the problems you're seeing. It's not corporate greed. You could take all the profit from every corporation in the country and you give it all back to people. It'll help for a while. But, you know, you could tax all the income of all the very 1% and it wouldn't help much, you know. It's not corporate greed that causes the problems that you're seeing. I mean, maybe it causes a little bit of something if you see, you know, egregious corporate greed. What causes it? Inflation. Inflation is long-time inflation. If you want to see what inflation looks like, just Google up the price of a candy bar, a quart of milk, college education, a car. Just Google it up over the last 100 years, and you'll see a continuous rise from left to right. And when you see that line, draw another line under it. But draw the line of the line under it as a little bit more gradual slope. So let's say the rising line goes from 1 to 100 over 100 years. Draw another line under it. That goes from 1 to 70. So the gap widens as you go further out. That gap is the income gap, what I call the affordability gap. And it shows that less and less people get affordable. I mean, if wages kept up with overall inflation, those two lines would be parallel. And it doesn't matter what inflation would do because your wages would match it. But wages never match. a rise in inflation. Never does. Wages are a lagging indicator in economics. The longer you run inflation, the more people fall under the bus because wages never keep up. Now, it's kind of stealthy and seductive because when we run inflation, your house prices go up and your wages go up and your stock prices go up. Everything you see goes up. So you say, well, I'm making more money. My wages increased every year. How come it's harder and harder to make ends meet? Because the overall price of what you pay has increased more than your wages. But it feels good. You know, I mean, in my opinion, if we see a deflationary environment, prices fall, the feds and many economic analysts don't want inflation because they say it gets into a deflationary spiral. And that's kind of, I've described that before in previous shows, but basically if inflation and wages are a lagging indicator, okay, prices go up, wages don't keep up. If prices go down fast, wages will fall, but they also don't keep up. So the prices of overall things that you buy would fall, but your wages would fall slower and the gap would reverse. That's the way I look at it. Now there's, I think I'll do a show on the deflationary gap, deflationary debt spiral, deflationary spiral downward and cover all that and kind of detail how that happens. But if inflation hurts the poor, what would deflation do? Right? Just logically, what would deflation do? If wages lag and prices rise, you get further behind. If wages fall, I mean, if prices fall and wages lag, the line reverses and you'll eventually catch up. Now, there are economists that would argue vehemently that you can't run a deflationary economy. And I'll get into that at some other point. Maybe a flatline economy would be much better, right? Let's just have prices stable. And there have been times in economic history where prices have remained stable. And that's the basic definition of a currency. Stable value. It remains stable. What you buy today with your dollar will buy the same thing 50 years from now. But we all know that's not true. So in any case, market. So today, let's take the final look at the damage since we're coming to the close of the show. Dow down 574. At 22,755, I can comfortably say that it probably won't close over 23,000. And it most likely won't go to 23,300 to close on a triple bottom. So now at 22,753, at least in the Dow, the major support level is 22,000 with minor support levels in between there. And now a major resistance level will be 23,000 above it. So if we go 22,745 divided by 26,833, oop, made a mistake. I'm trying to get the amount the Dow has fallen since this last high. So we get 22,880 divided by 26,833. And the Dow is off, gosh darn it. I can't do that math, why not? 22,800. All right, there. Divided by 26. Oh, I see what's happening. My iPhone is not really doing that correct. 22,880 divided by 26,833. We get a 15% Dow, just about a 15% correction in the Dow. Okay? Remember the death cross indicated more than a 20% drop in the next 2 years. So if this thing turns or stops there, then at least by the metrics that I used on the death cross number 34, which is the one we're in, will not have violated a 20% fall, at least in the Dow index. Now, some of the other indexes are greater. I mean, those have fallen more than 20%. Are we in a bear market? Well, bear market is 20% or more. I could say a lot of the indexes are. And the Dow is, you know, a lot of analysts will argue that we are in a bear market, which means it will be followed by a bull market. We just can't tell you when. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. And my name's Mark Cuniberti. You can check out the website, moneymanagementradio.com, if you like. It's free. There's no charges on it, any of it. And it's our way of saying thank you for listening to your community radio station. And that pretty much concludes show 279. Will it continue? When will it stop? It's very tough to say. Now, remember, as our disclaimer, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendation or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors, Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Views expressed are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, the station, its staff members, or underwriters. This is not a solicitation or recommendation to buy or sell any security. Indices mentioned are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investing involves risk. Depending on the types of investments, there may be varying degrees of risk. Investors should be prepared to bear loss, including total loss of principal. My name's Mark Cunaberti. God bless. And we'll hopefully look for maybe a late Santa Claus rally before he gets there, or maybe 2019. Stay true, watching the market so you don't have to. My name's Mark. Have a great day.